I'm going to begin today with a koan from the book The Record of Transmitting the Light, which is one of the collections of koans that we work on in Boundless Sui Zen, or maybe better than saying work on, play with. It's one of the collections that is comes down to us through our Soto line, our pure Soto line. And this is about a teacher named Liangshan Yuanguan. The 42nd ancestor was priest Liangshan. He studied with Tonggan the latter and served him. Tonggan asked him, "What is the business beneath the patch robe?" Liangshan had no answer. Tonggan said, "Studying the Buddha way and still not reaching this realm is the most painful thing. Now you ask me, and I will tell you." Liangshan asked, "What is the business beneath the patch robe?" Tonggan said, "Intimacy." The master was greatly awakened, the master being Liangshan. One of the things about this collection is that at the end of every koan, the student is awakened, or sometimes greatly awakened, or sometimes like enormously, greatly, incredibly awakened. There you have it. This story goes on after his awakening. He made full bows, and tears of gratitude wet his robe. Tonggan, the teacher, said, "Now that you have had a great awakening, can you express it?" Liangshan said he could. Tonggan asked, "What is the business beneath the patch robe?" Liangshan said, "Intimacy." Tonggan said, "Intimacy, intimacy." So this person, Liangshan, I Googled him to see if there was more information about him, and there's nothing on Google, which is really unusual for, I guess, everything. I should have maybe tried Bing, but I didn't. But there was a picture of him. He looked like a nice person. And he lived in the 10th century. He's just a few generations before Dogen. And this is a koan that's from the towards the end of this collection. This koan appealed to me to talk about today because, of course, I think most of you know, if not all of you, that a couple of people are going to receive the patched robe tonight. The patched robe is an old way of talking about the okesa, this this big robe that we wear if we're priests, over a few other interesting-looking garments. The garments date back from a few, maybe 1,000 years ago in China. They're adaptations of court garments. But the kesa itself goes all the way back to the Buddha, and it's similar to the robe, apparently, that he wore, and you know, it goes over, ties at the left shoulder. People in China and Japan, where it's cold, put on extra layers underneath. People in Southeast Asia often wear very little underneath this robe, and it's called a patched robe because traditionally in the Buddha's own Sangha, my understanding is that we would patch together. He would ask his students who ordained as priests to patch together the robe made up of various different kinds of materials that had been gathered at the charnel grounds, the grounds where people had been left to die or their clothes had been left. So these pieces of cloth were bleached and then colored with saffron, and they're sometimes called the saffron robe. So their yellow, our style is a little bit darker, kind of a muddy yellow brown for teachers. And for people who are ordaining, they get a black patch robe. So Liangshan was someone who, at least we can tell from this story and from the very little things we know about him, someone who was quite devoted to the way. If somebody at the end of a koan has a great awakening, you can be sure pretty much, I would say 99% of the time, that they didn't just start practicing a few minutes before the dialogue. These were people who had devoted their whole lives to the way. This process of refinement, of devotion, of dedication, of aligning with something that actually is a mystery to us when we first encounter it. We make up all kinds of things about what it means to be awake, and then we compare all of our experiences to our initial fantasy of what it means to be awake until a little moment or a big moment of awakening comes, and then all the fantasies dissolve into the reality of what we experience. This is something that I believe is really important, this dissolving of the fantasies about awakening. The actual experience itself is very hard to talk about. And there are other koans where people talk about intimacy as the most important thing. And this word intimacy, in English, it has a bunch of different meanings. I don't know Chinese or Japanese, but my understanding of the word that's being translated is it's not about the kind of intimacy that happens between two people who are in love with each other, although it has a flavor of that. It's about no separation between ourselves and the thing we are intimate with. So, of course, this can happen in a loving relationship. It can happen with our children, with our partners, with our parents, with dear friends. But this kind of intimacy even goes beyond all of those kinds of personal intimacies. This is an intimacy that is complete. We read something just now in the sutra service from Reb Anderson, and he has a lovely little line about intimacy where he says, he's talking about Shikantaza, of course, and he's describing the stillness of the Buddha's sitting as not merely stillness, it is complete presence and stillness. Complete presence and stillness. If you think that practice is just sitting around daydreaming, well, of course, it could be daydreaming, but it's not just drifting daydreaming, it's complete presence in daydreaming. There's not the slightest meddling, he says. It's physical and mental, non-interfering. We actually encourage ourselves to have a receptive quality, a receiving quality. Whatever is arising, this is it. And then he says, it is thorough intimacy with whatever is happening. Thorough intimacy with whatever is happening. So it's not just thorough intimacy with the beautiful flowers on the altar, or the sun coming in the window, or the sound of the softness of the air conditioner. It's thorough intimacy with everything, without picking or choosing, everything. So it's thorough intimacy with maybe daydreaming, maybe sleepiness, maybe feeling hot, maybe feeling cold. It's thorough intimacy, no separation, nothing in between. Whatever is arising is complete. Nothing outside of it. Everything is whatever is here now. And Reb Anderson goes on to say, this is an infinitely flexible stillness that can adjust to the impermanent nature of all things, harmonizing with all situations. So this aligning with everything, this harmonizing with everything, thorough intimacy, this is what I believe that the teacher in this koan is pointing to. This guy Tongan the Latter, it's L-A-T-T-E-R, there was another Tongan before him. He's saying to his student that the patch robe that you wear, the kesa, the clothing that you put on, is not the real thing. They're discussing what is the business beneath it? This is Tongan's question to his student. In other words, what is at the core of your being as a student of the way? What is it that is undeniably true? What is it that you are aligning with? And so the answer that he ends up giving, and I really love the moment when, of course, Liangshan can't answer. He has no answer. In a way, you could say, maybe that's an answer, but really, he's probably puzzled. He's stopped. And we can tell this because his teacher, Tongan, the latter, says to him, well, let me answer it for you. Why don't you ask me? What a lovely thing to do. You can't answer it. So he doesn't take out his stick and start hitting him. Answer it, answer it. He says, he just turns the tables around because he's already demonstrating intimacy. He's not taking a one-up position with his student. He is completely present in the interaction. There's just this asking, just this answering. I mean, it doesn't matter who's doing the asking, and it doesn't matter who's doing the answering. And it doesn't matter whether a person is ordained or lay. It doesn't matter whether we're men or women, where we come from, what we do for a living, because at the core of everything is only this intimacy. And I also love the way the story goes on. After he's had his awakening, and he cries and he soaks the robe with his tears. He is thoroughly intimate with his own awakening to intimacy. And the only response now is tears, kind of a dissolving, that dissolving of the old fantasy. And then Tongan says, now can you express it? And he says he can. Well, what is it then? It's intimacy. And then his teacher meets him. Intimacy. Intimacy. Some of you who work with koans know that there's a way of answering koans that we call flavorless words, where you use the words of the koan themselves to respond when there's a response that's requested. But this flavorless words, that is, words that have no flavor, they're not. There's nothing added to them, there's nothing extra. It's like clear broth with nothing to decorate it, nothing to spice it up, just the thing itself, the broth itself, unflavored, flavorless. But that can get to be a kind of a rote response, and my understanding is there are some schools of Zen where rote responses are required, and these rote responses can be given in a kind of flat, dull way. And what a teacher's looking for is an aliveness in the response, even if the student is using the words of some ancient master. The words become our own. We become intimate with them, completely intimate. And that's why Tongan, the teacher, can say in response to his student Liangshan's intimacy, intimacy, intimacy. We can be pretty sure that they didn't say intimacy, intimacy, intimacy. It had something intimate in it, completely intimate. The only place I've been able to find anything else about Liangshan is in Andy Ferguson's wonderful book, Zen's Chinese Ancestors. And again, no dates. We don't know when he was born. We don't know when he was when he died. We only know he was a disciple of this guy, Tongan, the latter. But apparently he, according to Keizan, who collected the transmission of the light koans, he was someone who often spoke of intimacy. He spoke of it in this way that we're speaking of it. No separation, complete presence with everything arising. And apparently he had a habit of reciting a poem that he wrote. And the poem, to me, is a little bit touching. We know he had a Dharma heir because, at least according to Keizan, there's another koan after this where Liangshan transmits the Dharma to one of his students. But this is the poem that he would recite. The song of Liangshan. Even the skilled find it hard to sing. These 10 years I've searched for someone to sing it, But till now, I've found no one. So here again, we have another expression of intimacy, and it's not the thing itself, but the other important thing that is connected to intimacy, the longing for intimacy. For many of us, when we encounter this path, this longing is what pulls us forward. The longing to connect. We feel the separation deeply. We feel it at our core. We feel apart, alone. No one can understand us. And then we encounter this way and we begin to suspect, perhaps, that maybe there are people who can understand us. And then we find that it's not just people, but it's every single thing. We can find a way to encounter our aloneness as intimacy. And in that moment, there is a shift, a deep shift at our core, and we realize that we are one with all beings, the moon and the stars, the trees and the floor, the tiles and pebbles, everything. Everything is who we are. No separation. Nothing in between. And I like Liangshan's metaphor that this is a song we learn to sing. Every teacher sings their own song. Every student sings his or her own song. And when the two songs come together, there's what we call harmony. A harmonizing, an aligning. This aligning is beyond words and ideas and fantasies, but it's known at the core. It's known in the deepest place. The collection of Keizan, where this koan comes from, always has a little verse appended to the end that Keizan wrote. And he's kind of funny. I've come to really enjoy the way he introduces the verses, because he almost always says, I don't know how I'm going to say this, but anyway, here. And it's kind of like a real admission of there's no way to say this, but I'm going to come up with some way. And the title of the record, it's Denko Roku in Japanese. It's a Japanese text, actually, not a Chinese text. And the transmission of the light. What is this light that's being transmitted? Well, this is another way, perhaps, of talking about what happens when we are so in alignment, when our song harmonizes, that we feel something bright inside of us and around us. Maybe this is why the words Kensho and Satori were, I feel, mistranslated as enlightenment. But there is some kind of a presence of this light that shines out of everything that we recognize as our light, the light. And the translation that I'm reading from, which is by Francis Cook, has one version of the poem, but I really like the version that we use in our koan practice that's translated by John Tarrant and Joan Sutherland. So here's that translation. Keizan's verse. The water is clear to the very bottom. Without being polished, it is bright by its nature. The water is clear to the very bottom. Without being polished, it is bright by its nature. So when we talk about Buddha nature, the true nature, we're talking about something that shines with its own light. And when we become intimate with our lives, when we become intimate with everything, we hear that song, we see that light. The 42nd ancestor was Priest Liangshan. He studied with Tongan the latter and served him. Tongan asked him, what is the business beneath the patch robe? Liangshan had no answer. Tongan said, studying the Buddha way and still not reaching this realm is the most painful thing. Now you ask me, and I will tell you. Liangshan asked, "What is the business beneath the patch robe?" Tonggan said, "Intimacy." Liangshan was greatly awakened. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and people behind the fireplace, if you want to come out and bring your seats to the main hall. So this is a time where we take our vow of silence and set it to the side, and we can talk and we can ask questions, we can make comments. So all you have to do is raise your hand. I can't see very many people, so David and James are going to be paying
attention. No hands.
No hands so far. Mike?
The longing that you were talking about is something that I feel very familiar with. And There's also a sense of intimacy. And it's interesting that, for me anyway, one doesn't replace the other.
And so this intimacy, the wonderful thing about it is that it's not dependent on any particular mind state or any particular circumstance. So this practice, if the practice is intimacy and not clarity or not satisfaction, or so then in dissatisfaction or in the longing, when we're present, we are we're met, and there's some fullness and completeness that doesn't need to be fixed or improved or anything, just the great longing, a beautiful expression.
For me, this is where we move into the deep waters, where we see all the problems and missteps, and you know, this is a dangerous path because it's easy to there are so many near enemies around this this practice, or simply confusing the belonging and the intimacy and going down paths that are not helpful. It's an amazing, you know, it's this lovely. Dangerous thing. And I just love that Melissa picked this for, you know, the ordination sermon, as it were. What is this patched robe that you're putting on, and what's beneath it? And yet it's appropriate to every one of us, whatever our you know, path is. You know, it's the same thing.
One of the things that struck me so much was this idea about separation, and that how so many of us come to Zen because we feel a sense of separation from life. And what strikes me is that even the moment where I can notice that where I begin to feel intimate with that feeling of separateness, something happens. even that terrible and painful state, there's something about it that turns, that eases the suffering even as it's still painful.
I really appreciate, James, you saying that it's a dangerous path, because I would also say it takes courage to go down this dangerous path, because when this being intimate with even the worst things about, we think they're the worst things, I mean, from the outside they don't look so bad, but inside, there really is a great courage to make the intention to be a person of the way. And you know, I also love that you said there are near enemies, because there's a way to do it where you can just pretend to be this person. You're wearing the robe, but inside you're just like, stay away from me, stay away from me. Like, there isn't that intimacy. So it's a rocky, thorny. And luckily, we're not alone in it. Last night I was thinking, we settled in. Paul noticed how quickly we settled down in, you know, our first Zazen period. Well, maybe not internally. I'm just realizing that certainly from the outside, the robe looked good. But I thought how lucky we are to be together. You know, that we've all decided to do this. Even if we have a fantasy about what it means, that doesn't even matter. We all have fantasies. How can we not? But just the fact that we're going down this road together is so heartening to me. Brave, foolish souls.
Diane.
And something about the talk also brought to my mind the instruction about not picking and choosing, and the and being intimate with that picking and choosing. You know, that the picking and choosing nature arises, and it's no denying it. You know, it's so how, you know, being intimate.
Thank you, Dan. Was there somebody else down here before we go to Laura? I thought I saw another hand. No?
The line in the story that, part of the story that really struck me was that this student who had been practicing for a really long time couldn't answer his teacher's question. Mm-hmm. You're comment about you can pretty much guarantee he didn't just start the day before. You know, he'd been practicing and studying a long time. And when his teacher asked, he didn't have an answer. And I can only imagine the thoughts in his mind. Oh, I've been studying for so long and I still don't get it. The teacher just added, I can't answer. You know, whatever those thoughts were of like, oh, I'm never going to get it, or whatever it was that he was thinking. And that wall, that hitting that wall of who I am when I hit that wall. Mm-hmm. And then I too was very struck by that line. Can't remember the words exactly, but something like studying this way for so long and not disappointing or disheartening.
The most painful
thing in the world, you know. And then his generosity of showing him, you know. But I think the recognition, the teacher's recognition of studying so hard and really trying to walk this way and not being able to answer the question. Such a pain. Right. And I could just, you know, my heart said, yeah, yeah.
How about Julie first?
The story just had me reflecting on the idea of being prepared. One thing that was going through my mind as I came to Sashin here was that I'm just really not prepared for this. It's, you know, just kind of falling in the middle of a busy part of life, and I'm not prepared. And, I love the story where he's faced with a question, he can't answer it, and then the story goes on from there. I find that very encouraging.
There is, you know, I think anything that arises in us in that moment of silence is like a wonderful mirror for us. Like, we're never going to know what Liangshan, what was going through his mind. But we know it was going through the teacher's mind, at least because he reached out into that moment of unpreparedness and said, this is the most painful thing. I think you're pointing to something, Laura, just to name it. This is the most painful thing. But you ask me now, I'll tell you. You know, I just, wow, that's so great. And he must have seen that it wasn't just confusion, but that there was something that was about to spark, too, you know, arising with whatever else was arising. Yeah, so tender, so touching. So being prepared could get in the way.
Mm-hmm.
I what you were saying was so, like, I imagine the two being in that conversation when the student says, I don't have an answer, like, this is already this incredibly intimate moment between the two of them, like, already happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so the teacher says, you do know, you just don't know that you know. That's how I see it. Like, he's this, they're both these very vulnerable, present, open people with one another, and then the teacher says, it's just this. It's what we're doing right here. It's intimacy. And the student, he's like, oh. Like, it resonated. He knew, already knew. That's how I hear that. Because he was so ready to hear it, he just started bawling because it was already happening.
Thanks.
Oh, I had another question. That's why I raised my hand before.
This is for James in particular.
Yes, yeah. Actually. I'm wondering if you would say more about near enemies.
Near enemies. Well, what came immediately to mind when we talk about intimacy are the, you know, our inheritance of scandals. But really, it's much bigger than that. I mean, it's the constant misunderstandings of the way. I had a little bit of correspondence recently with a dear old friend. Somebody who's been practicing this way for, I don't know, 30 years or so. And has, you know, really gotten deep, but has a part of her personality that is, that doesn't believe herself. And at this moment, she's in this kind of dark place where she thinks knocking off koans has been nothing, you know, that it's, and she's despairing. In that place. And yet this is one of the people that I've seen in other ways be the most clear, you know, I mean, it really pulling that deep sense of intimacy in how she interacts with other people, but she won't cut that slack for herself. Yeah, and there's a near enemy going on at this moment for her. And it was just one more, you know, that was just echoing in the back of my heart. I think there's more prosaic things for us as well. So we're talking in the context of our the big event this evening, and the precepts ceremony that's going to take place at the near the end of Sesshin. It's all these promises that we make, and how we're condemned to fail, and we can take it as the path of intimacy, you know, one continuous mistake as the celebration of this path, or we can, you know, or it can be a terrible barrier and, you know, guilt and shame and what do we do?
So I wanted to go back to this moment that Laura was pointing to, the students, and then of course we don't really know, you know, anything about the students' background, but what came up for me was, you know, perhaps this guy had been a student for a long time and had already had some awakenings and some realization, and to, you know, be asked a question by the teacher and not being able to respond in spite of, you know, having had some awareness, and the teacher recognized, so this is the most painful thing to to have had these difficulties in the past and watch them resolve and still be stuck yet again in this place of not being able to answer. And what tremendous pain it is to be in that place. And then the teacher's words, so, you know, be intimate with this pain, and perhaps it was, you know, the intimacy with that moment of pain yet again that something broke, you know, even this is it, and having even a great realization perhaps still didn't make it so that, you know, he would never be stuck in that place again, you know, that you know, we don't just resolve these things once and for all, and to have been a student with some success perhaps and find ourselves locked yet again in a place of not being able to respond when we're called forward, you know, over and over again.
I feel familiar.
Yeah. Well, and that's a lovely near enemy, you know, is that our path really is a spiral path, and we sometimes think it's supposed to be a circle, and, you know, and we close it, and we're, you know, our ship doesn't sink, and then it does, and we're caught. You know, what does that mean? And, you know, I think it's also kind of interesting that of our three transmission lines that flow into becoming the boundless way, this is a teacher, the person who's feeling so failed, who feels that pain, is one of our direct ancestors in one of the three lines, the priestly line. So, yeah. He's ours and he's us.
Well, and we sometimes talk about great faith, great determination, and great doubt. And sometimes we soft pedal the doubt, like, oh, it's curiosity, you know. And sometimes, yes, you know, what is this constantly heading in? But yet, this place of real doubt, of have I wasted my life? Right? Like, is this? Am I just so totally failed? So great tradition, but clearly not for somebody like me. And that place of when we finally realize that we are totally unprepared. 30 years of sitting. So what? Huh? Yeah, in this moment, I've run out of my skillful means. And precisely this place that is the biggest pain, the biggest what is most wrong with me. Is the entry place. You know, again and again, I think all of us sitting in this room have had some taste of that, some place where we are totally unprepared, where we're totally sure we are the great exception. And then something happens. You know, some teacher, the sound of the bird as the teacher, or the delicious oatmeal in the morning. Something becomes our teacher. But I think we are only accessible when we are in that vulnerable place. As long as we've got our robe of self on, oh yeah, I'm pretty cool. I've done this before. Yeah, I've done 40 retreats. You know, there's nothing can come in. And we are indeed alone. But that moment when we have gone beyond, and not in a very sweet, loving way, gone beyond what we can tolerate, then something, a word, a phrase, a glance, a breath, and we cry and laugh and whatever.
What came up for me was, as I was listening to this, was something that happened at a Dharma dialogue a few months ago. I did this at the at a Unitarian church where they have once a month a Buddhist discussion group. And
they had invited me to lead this particular discussion. They knew each other really well. They didn't know me, so they wanted to see what might come out of that would shake things up a little, which maybe turned out not as they had intended. But anyway, there was... So one of the things that I suggested up front was that we speak from our own experience, speak from our heart, not just cogitating and analyzing. And so, you know, things went along, and then about a half hour in, I realized that there was one person who hadn't said anything. He was the most elderly of the group, and he was just sitting and sort of studying the floor. And so I turned to him and asked him if there was anything that he would like to contribute, something to add. And he said he really didn't feel that he could speak in this particular forum because of the conditions that had been placed upon him to speak from the heart. He said he used his head when he thought and when he spoke, and that he wasn't having any part of this talking without thinking about it. And it struck me as such a pure expression of really speaking from the heart. That in spite of himself, he was singing the song of who he was.
Yes.
You know, that he shone with it. And it was a wonderful moment. Mm. And yet painful for him. And so I think maybe the same thing for this monk, that in his saying, in his not being able to answer, nevertheless, he was being so bright and shining in that not knowing what to say. Mm.
That's it. Oh, yeah. Mm.
And I love the fact that sometimes we can think that we're hiding. Mm. Well, I'm not going to speak from my heart, goddammit. and totally exposed. But I think not in the way we fear. You know,
right.
We fear someone's going to see us and then they'll judge us and think. But I think when we truly see each other, there's, you know, each one of us already shining, already brilliant. Yeah. How wonderful. Dominic.
The line that I'm kind of stuck on is this line about how not being able to answer is the most painful thing. Why is it the most painful thing?
Well, actually, it wasn't not being able to answer. It was studying the Buddha way and still not reaching this realm is the most painful thing. So the realm being what's underneath the robe, the essential matter. Right? So you can separate those two concepts. My suspicion is that the teacher was seeing that he really had touched the essential matter and was coaxing him out of the silence. You know, there's many ways of interpreting it, but that's my understanding. So it's not that you couldn't, you know, your failure to speak is not the most painful thing. But, I mean, I can identify with it, too. I think we've been talking about it a little bit. You know, those moments when we compare what's happening to our fantasy of what we think should be happening, that's really painful. Really, ouch. And so the teacher's almost nudging him towards intimacy. Well, I think what Mike was pointing out, the intimacy is already present in his recognizing wherever you are right now, you're not in touch with the great matter, but we're sitting in it. You know, we're just like, right, we're in the ocean, we're soaking wet, but you're not quite there. That's really painful. And then, boom, there it is. Just by him saying, you ask me, I'll show you, I'll tell you. It's kind of sweet. I can't see you at all, so I don't know where my words are landing.
What is most painful?
Well, I mean, I can make a really long list.
But the short list for you?
The essential thing.
I mean, if we're talking about this.
Well, the reason I brought it up is yesterday, Mike, Bob, and I were having a slightly amusing conversation about ordination, and the essence of it was that sometimes we know why we put on our robes, and sometimes we have no idea most of the rest of the time, it's like I just kind of put it on. And for me, that's just kind of part of the flavor of it.
So you're saying not here is the most painful part. Where is the most painful part?
Well, I mean, for me, the things that are more painful than coming in and out of reaching that realm are, for example, watching somebody I love die. Watching somebody I see in excruciating pain. That just crushes me. But yeah, the coming and going of knowing what it is that's on the road is, and I guess I wouldn't have said it that way, so I was curious about it.
Yeah. And I guess I'm just asking because for all of us, there is some place where we go to the most painful thing. And, you know, so many entry places in, for the koan. So we can say, well, gee, that's not such a big deal. Sometimes I know, sometimes I don't. But there is some place in our life. And certainly, you know, you mentioned, you know, in our everyday world, life and death, and really seeing someone in pain or being present with that. But I think the... for me, the koan points to that most painful part, the most difficult, as included in this. Yeah.
I would say if it's just coming and going, that it excludes the question of pain and a friend dying. It's not the coming and going. You know, it's slipped into a near enemy. It's too conceptual, too removed, and another one of those shadows of our way. You know, it's easy to do that, you know. And we need to always, you know, the coming and going. If it doesn't have death and destruction and atom bombs and Ebola viruses, it's not it.
I think that's actually quite a lovely place to
the Ebola viruses, yes.